overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life. I am.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration Service for the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
Well, good morning. I just was given the finger in the face saying you're on. So I want to make a few announcements first. The first is that we're going to be moving our clocks ahead next week. My beloved husband said, make sure you tell everybody because they never hear the message. So because I'm not that technical on the computer, I'm telling you in person to set your clocks ahead, spring ahead, and that will give you less time to sleep, but more time in the evening. And that's next Saturday night. The other thing is we have a new class that's starting this Tuesday and Wednesday, and it's going to be based on a book by Pema Chodron called Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change. We've taught it before many years ago, and it's very relevant because she talks about the moral ambiguity of human existence. Now, don't you love that phrase, the moral ambiguity of human existence? And by that, she means it's ambiguous because what most people are seeking is stability and certainty and safety and predictability. She says, but that's not the way of the universe. The universe is all about change. In order to be alive, we have to be willing to change, and we have to be willing to face a thing called uncertainty. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson that says, we all seek to be certain, but only to the degree that you are uncertain is there any hope for you. You know, my beloved Matt's here with his new fiance. Do they call them fiancés? And in my era, we call them partners, but now we can get married. And when you make a commitment to a relationship, that is filled with uncertainty. We've been together 45 years. I am surprised that we were able to stay together that long because that first year was really tumultuous. We were so young, we didn't know where we were. Anybody who's been in relationships knows that. So what if we, by the very nature of this moral ambiguity of human existence, we open to the uncertainty. And so Pema Chodron, in this lovely little book, she asks this simple question, how can we make friends with uncertainty? How can we make friends with change? Someone humorously said to me, the only one that really embraces change is a baby whose diaper is dirty. And I even questioned that analogy. Yet we're afraid to change, because change means that we have to let go of what we thought we knew, where we thought we were going. And we all like consistency. We all like predictability until we don't. My prayer partner from Canada was commenting on how wonderful the vaccination is going in America. He says the Canadians aren't on top of it. And so he was singing President Biden's praises. He says, I can't believe that we're going to have, anybody can have a vaccination by the end of, what is it? May? He says in Canada, they're talking years out. So he was singing our praises down here, and it's rare for him to sing the praises of America. So I'll take any praise that we can get from Canada. So yeah, but these are uncertain times. I haven't had my shot yet. I'm hopefully getting it this Friday, and Lord willing. And I was asking the folks here, if I get it on Friday, will I be able to speak on Sunday? And some say, oh, I was sicker than a dog. Some say, I just had a little soreness in my arm. So I've got uncertainty there. Or you might say anxiety, Mary, but I'm just going to let the anxiety move right through. Because that's what anxiety does. It's running anxiety. It doesn't have to stay. And yet, then we can be loving with ourselves when those moments arise where we do feel kind of, what am I going to do? What do I really know? It's okay to not know. It's okay to have confusion. It's okay to be anxious. Then anxiousness is there. It's okay to have confrontation with the truth with somebody. You know, I've learned as a minister, when I have to say something difficult to someone, if I say it with love, it's received with love. You know, I don't want you picking up my pug because I think you might drop it because you've had a few drinks, and I don't want you lifting the pug up and possibly dropping him and having another herniated disc. Does that mean I don't love them? No, it means that I'm being protective of my pug. And you know, he's just learning to walk again. It's so cute to have a dog that was paralyzed a year ago. You know, your mom was with us then, and she had worked for a vet, and she was telling me that this can be a miraculous surgery. But when you've never had an animal that's paralyzed from the neck down, it's incredulous that the muscles can start working again, and that he can figure out how to put one foot in front of the other. You know, it's amazing. And now, this morning, he ran up the back steps. He literally ran up the back steps. So here I have all this joy with this little pug who came back to life, and I have the old, well, Bert's 15 now, and you know, my hips don't work very good. And so when he goes to go down the back steps, sometimes his hips fall out from under him. And then I go in and give him a little massage, and I'm giving him, he won't eat his food anymore, so I'm giving him little raviolis. By that, I mean I slice pieces of turkey, and I'll put a little sweet potato in, maybe I'll put a little Rimadyl for his hips, and he'll just sit one little turkey. One little turkey. Trey makes scrambled eggs on Sunday morning, and I'm getting ready for church, and he's downstairs getting their breakfast, and Bert wouldn't eat his scrambled eggs, so he said I had to go raviolis with the scrambled eggs. Put a little scrambled egg in the ravioli. And if this is what you have to do when they're 15, it's what you have to do when they're 15. So every day is filled with an amazing opportunity to embrace the life that we've been given. And this month of March, I'm going to be exploring the idea of a sanctuary garden. There's a garden book in my library at home called The Sanctuary Garden, and I like it when they'll take something that you're really passionate about and turning it into something sacred. So what if we could see this center as a garden, where we're gardening the soul of humanity, and we're tending the soul? What if you could reference your own personal life as a garden? What seeds are you planting in the consciousness that you've been given? Last week, I was talking about Thich Nhat Hanh, one of my teachers, and he did that very simple idea of drawing a circle on a whiteboard. He says, this is your consciousness. We all have consciousness, right? And he says, and then he did these little black dots. And he says, those are seeds. And he asked the question, what seeds are you watering in your garden? Are you watering the seeds of fear, the seeds of anxiety, the seeds of doubt? If you are, then they'll begin to grow within your consciousness. But he says, we're always at choice point what we're going to water. I have a little book called Heart Songs by Maddox Stepanek. He died at age 11, a young man, but he wrote poetry, and I was going to bring it today. I didn't bring it, Gene. He wrote a poem for hope, and he says, I water the seeds of hope every day, that I hope we can learn to love one another. I hope we can care for the animals. I hope we care for the trees. I hope we care for the environment. You know, I hope that there is a cure for this disease that I have, that I won't have to live in pain. So here he wrote this beautiful poem at age 11, about hope, and he made his transition, but his prayer lives on. So could we water those seeds within ourselves, the seeds of compassion? Last week I spoke about love, and Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a little book called The Treatise, Teachings on Love, and he talked about love in a different sort of way. He said that there's the four immeasurable aspects of mind. And just to remind you of them, because I've been working with it all week. When I do a talk on Sunday, hopefully it'll work on you throughout the week and you'll begin to experience subtle shifts. Like when we found the inner critic last week who showed up at our revealing service. All week long, I'm dealing with my inner critic who showed up. And I'm greeting. Oh, there he is again. You know, he's got his criticism. He's got his judgment. He's got his concerns. And I've learned to listen to the inner critic and say thank you for sharing. And with that, he doesn't feel like he's abandoned or rejected, you know. So in the four immeasurable aspects of mind in the Buddhist tradition, and some of us really connect with this Buddhist teaching because in a strange sort of way, it's science of mind. His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, Buddhism is at its core a science of mind. In other words, we look at the nature of consciousness. And they say in Buddhism, all life is suffering because we get caught up in what we call the little mind. And the little mind has thoughts and beliefs and conclusions. And you know, your conclusions can drive you crazy. If you have a conclusion about somebody else and you've labeled them as that, we did a beautiful generational healing this week. It was one of my favorites. And we realized that we only experience our perception of something. And when that perception shifts ever so slightly and we stop labeling them with our conclusions, then everything begins to change. So it's all an inside job. There's a lovely poster in the bookstore that says, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. I was on this prayer call with my prayer partner this morning, and we were talking about the present that we had before. and the confusion in this country. And he was asking about, it's been 2 months since you had that siege on the Capitol and what's happening down there. Cause he's way up in Vancouver and he wanted to know. And he said, you know, he said, my feelings about he who shall not be named is that I have compassion for him. And so he and I began to dialogue. What is this thing called compassion? You know, we both came to this kind of softer conclusion that he must have been an abused child. He wasn't loved. And so that behavior becomes aberrant when you haven't had the upbringing that really nurtures you as a child. So I began to see he who shall not be named with different eyes. And in those four immeasurable aspects of love, according to Thich Nhat Hanh, one is compassion. You begin to have compassion for other people. That doesn't mean you have to sympathize or agree, but you can have compassion for those that are suffering out there. I was telling at the revealing service, there was a little mouse that I found in the basement. And, you know, some people think mice are little versions of rats, but he was the cutest little thing, and he was struggling to get out of the basement. And I literally coddled the little mouse in my hand, and the little nose was little, and he did little lips and little tiny feet, and he was just precious. I was telling him, I've seen Cinderella. He's like one of the ones that Cinderella would feed with the little crumbs. But he was in the basement, so I scooped him up, and I brought him outside. And he fell off the thing that I was carrying, and he broke his neck, and he died in my arms. And I'm thinking, I've got guilt. But compassion started it, and then went into guilt. And you see how these immeasurable aspects of mind work. Another one of them is equanimity. You begin to see it's all aspects of God. It's so funny, last week I talked about when I was walking in a walking meditation with Thich Nhat Hanh, the worms were coming out in Ascutney, Vermont, because we'd had a lot of rain. And the next morning, I get a text from Adam, and he said, I went for a walk this morning, and all I can see are worms everywhere I go. And he says, what is this? And I said, well, there are no accidents, Adam. I said, the worms come out of the ground, but now you're aware that the worms are there. So he said, I found myself taking them off the pathway and putting them into grass. And isn't that something that the compassionate heart would do? Because there's equanimity. They're not just a lowly worm on the sidewalk. They're an aspect of life. When Al cleans out the aquarium in Chattanooga, he doesn't think them as just little fishies. They're part of his community. And there's a beauty. So there's equanimity. There's compassion. Then another aspect that Thich Nhat Hanh mentioned was a natural joy, a joy of being in the present moment. When you're living in the joy of now, you don't talk about tomorrow when I'll be in El Paso. You don't talk about yesterday when I was in the Bahamas. You're in this beautiful now moment of, and in that, the future and the past can come and join you, but they're arising within present moment awareness. So that's another place of the immeasurable aspect of mind or heart that Thich Nhat Hanh says we take refuge in. But my favorite of all of them was, see the multidimensionality of your own consciousness, was loving kindness, was the other fourth aspect of this immeasurable mind that we all share. Now remember, it's not the local mind. The local mind, there's a non-local mind that we're all accessing. You could call it the infinite mind, where we meet, a meeting of minds in a higher order of awareness. And that's the place where we unite. So this month, I'm talking about the sanctuary garden, what we create within ourselves. And this particular Sunday, in case you want a title for the talk, because Michael usually asks me what the title is, and then he types it in, it's called Return to the Center. And it's from a little book by Bede Griffith. Now, Bede Griffith is an interesting man. He was a Benedictine monk who went over to India. He was born in 1906. He went to India, in the 50s, and he never left India. And he lived there for 32 years. He became a sannyasin. But when he speaks, he carries the wisdom of the Christian theology, the Hindu teachings, the Buddhist teachings, the Muslim teachings, and it all comes out as truth, truth from the heart. And he talks about returning to the center. In all the great spiritual paths, they talk about going home to the truth of who you are. And he said, Jesus called it the kingdom of heaven. And he said, it lies within you. And he says, seek it first, and everything is added unto you. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is spread out upon the earth, but mankind does not see it. So what is he saying? Is he contradicting himself? He's saying it's within, and it's all around you. It's all the kingdom. There's not a spot where God is not. And so then, in Thich Nhat Hanh's version of connecting with the universe, he would say, observe the sky and the vastness of the universe. He says, you are that, and that is God. It's this vast something that is so all-encompassing. And then he says, now bring your attention to the smallest of things, to the little worm on the sidewalk, or the little baby mouse in the basement, or the flower that's blooming in the garden. You know, the one beautiful thing about having gardens like I do is that they're always showing you yesterday's seeds that you planted. I witness all these strange people walking through my front yard, and they're taking photographs of the flowers. And I realized I don't just grow them for my pleasure. I grow them for the community. The neighbor lady, her mother just made her transition, and I used to bring camellias to her mother when she was alive. And so I know that the mother, who was in her 90s, loved, I think she died at 100. She loved those damn camellias. So I went and I picked a bunch of camellias. You thought I would have given her a basket of gold. She says, oh, you don't know what this does for my soul. So this morning I got a photograph. She assembled the camellias on the table, and they're the reds and the pinks, and there's that thing called Dahlonega, which is a soft yellow, and she just did a big tableau of camellias because it awoke something in her heart. So what if we get to find our center in whatever way we can? And B. Griffith says, in the Hindu tradition, they'll say the Atman and the Brahman are one. The Atman is the soul. And you know, we're not a body with a soul. We're a soul with a body. The soul is eternal. The soul of Jane Stearns is still here. The body is no longer here. And when you know yourself as this eternal soul, and the Atman, the soul that we all are, and the Brahman, which is this infinite, vast God of the universe, are one. He says they're saying the same thing. In the Quran, it says, I was a hidden treasure, and I longed to be known, so I created the world. So what if we are this treasure, this pearl of great price, that Jesus said, seek it first and everything is added unto you, but you have to find it, and whatever your tradition is, to find that. You know, I went to get a prescription filled at the pharmacy, and I asked the lady behind the booth with the glass or the plastic and the masks on. I says, how are you doing? You're on the front lines here. And she says, I've got me some Jesus last Sunday. I'm feeling much better. And I said, well, good for you. You got you some Jesus. You know, now we don't give you Jesus here. We give you something much different. We give you this recognition that you are the vastness of the universe, which includes Jesus, yes, but it's not exclusive to him. So could we evolve into a higher order of realization? And I'm going to give you a taste of this beautiful saintly man who died in 1992. I have a photograph of him in my office. And here's, you know, there are no accidents, like Adam walking out and seeing all the worms last Monday. In 1993, I was at the Parliament of the World Religions in Chicago, the first one they'd had in 100 years. The first one was in 1893. I'm a young minister. B. Griffith died in May of 1993. And I stumbled into a room. There were hundreds of people there. I didn't know what I was going to be hearing. And they were doing a memorial service for him. And I heard what a saintly man he was from these different people who spoke about him. And from then on, I went out and I began to know him posthumously. And you know what they say, the ancestors live in you. So part of B. Griffith lives in me, and I never met the man, but yet I feel his presence. So let me just give you a taste of how he inspires. B. Griffith says this, if we could go down into the depths of any being, and remind you today, we're talking about returning to the center. He said, if we could go down into the depths of any being, be it a grain of sand, a leaf, a flower, we should come upon the same eternal mystery. We all meet in that mystery, in the Brahman. You know, beyond the molecules and the atoms, beyond the protons and the electrons, beyond the living cell with its genes and its chromosomes, there is an energy. There is an energy. Eckhart Tolle would call it the presence. You can feel the presence. It's right there. There is an energy. There is a force of life which is continually welling up from the abyss of being in the Father. Now, because he was a Benedictine monk, he used the word father. You could call it Brahman. You could call it the Tao, that infinite something out of which everything arises. So he says, when we go deep within ourselves, we find this energy that's there, the energy of the Father, continually springing up into the light of the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the world dwelt among them. The Word is the expression of truth. So he's showing his Christian roots, continually springing up into the light of the Word, continually flowing back to its source in the bliss of love, returning to its source in the bliss of love. And he says, this is the divine Sachit Ananda. Now remember, he was 32 years in India. Sachit Ananda, Sat, consciousness, Chit, beingness, Ananda, bliss, consciousness, being, bliss. He called it the Trinity of Sachit Ananda. You could call it the triune nature of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Same thing. We fall into this loving, awakened presence that we all share. Now, he's inviting us to return to that Sachit Ananda, the divine Sachit Ananda, or the Holy Trinity. And it lies at the heart of every creature. It lies at the heart of every creature. My Zen calendar this morning said, learn to listen with the ears of your heart. Let those who have ears to hear. If you listen with the ears of your heart, you'd have compassion for all the suffering on the planet. Not just the suffering that you agree with, but all the suffering. So he's seeking to us to waken the heart. It lies in the heart of every creature. As the Upanishads say, quote, the self, smaller than the small, greater than the great, is hidden in the heart of every creature. A man who is free from desires and free from grief sees the majesty of this self by the grace of our Creator. And this mystery is hidden in the heart of every human. But we oftentimes fail to see it. So it's hidden within our hearts. We fail to see it. So this whole book is about returning to this something, to this love that we all share. And he talks about four stages. I like it when they give you kind of a formula. They don't tell you the why, they tell you the how. And he says the first one is to surrender your thoughts to this spacious field of awareness. Terry knows what I'm talking about. Surrender your thoughts to this mind. Can do that kind of, can feel into that. Then the second phase, B. Griffith says, is surrender now the mind into the knowing self. There's something that knows even when our mind doesn't know. You know, we want to have the answers. The mind wants answers, whereas the soul wants to find meaning. So could we go to this knowing self that doesn't need answers? And then he says, then you get to surrender the knowing self. We're going even deeper. And you surrender to the peace that passes all understanding. Now, could you just taste that peace? It's not a peace that's conditional. You can be in a pandemic and have an insurrection and you can still be at peace. So he's saying, go directly to that peace. First, you go to the mind, you surrender the mind. Then you go to this knowingness that's beyond you and you surrender that. And then you ultimately surrender any need to know to this peace. You don't have to know. You don't have to have the answers to the questions. All you have to know is that when I am loving and I express from love, you know this with your little girl, that she receives it from love. And sometimes love is tough love. No, don't touch the stove. You'll get burnt. Yeah. No, don't drink and drive because you could get in an accident. No, don't, whatever. Trey found that we had hornets that had nested in our lamp on the Botanica. And all of a sudden fear arose. And he did the dastardly decision that he was going to exterminate the wasps because he felt that they might get pissed off and come and swarm around him when he's out there reading his book. So he made the executive decision. He absolved himself and forgave himself. And then he did what he had to do in order to return to center, ultimately, after having done something that he didn't feel good about doing. So, yeah, we're going to talk about returning to center here this Sunday. And you get to discover how you do it for yourself. I find that my garden is a way that I center myself. To just go out, like beautiful Jude is here, and she found that when she gets out on the water in her sailboat, it returns her to her center. There's something about being on the water, that connection. I know that Gigi, when she swims in the ocean, it takes her to her center. When Raul sings in Spanish his beautiful music, it takes him to his center. When Terry throws a pot and she's in that clay, it takes her to her center. So could we be courageous enough to discover what is it, my beloved Jane Stearns, she came to one of our final classes and she brought everybody a Christmas ornament. And I still have that ornament hanging in my bathroom because I see all the love she put into it. So she would get great joy out of creating art and then sharing that art with the world. So what if we could discover where we find this center and let it flower, returning to that, returning to service, returning to compassion, returning to the sailing, returning to the garden, returning to the present moment. And then just resting there, resting in the center. There's a wonderful saying that says we don't want to live at the circumference of life, because the circumference is where all the drama is. But if we lived from that center place, that's where the peace abides. It lies stretched in smiling repose, as Emerson would say. So could we return to this center and then let our doing come from this beingness? I am being peaceful, and yet I'm sailing a ship. I am being loving, and I'm changing a diaper. I am being compassionate, and I am relating to the people that I'm challenged by. So could we let our doing come from that being and make it a spiritual practice, make it a discipline? That's what all spiritual practice is anyway. I wanted to give you somebody that I think does this returning to the center better than most people, and it's a beautiful poet and a teacher of mine called Mark Nepo, and this is his latest book. It's called Drinking from the River of Life, Light, the Life of Expression. And he talks about there's one light, it's God's light, and it wants an avenue to express. And so what if this light that comes up from within wants to reveal itself, but we have to be willing to access it from within? And so here's how he, in his beautiful poetic way, describes that process of returning to center. He says, all the meditative traditions in the world encourage us to be still and to drop our thoughts and feelings so that we can breathe our way below all trouble into a flow of a life force that carries us. There's that energy again, that life force. To breathe our way into this life force that's always there. So the first way to return is to just learn to consciously breathe or mindfully breathe, like we said last week. Let your breath be dynamic. You know, it's the one thing we can't live without. We can live without food, we can live without water, but we can't live without this breath. That's why this COVID thing is so dramatic when people lose their breath. The other day I was eating something and I got something caught in my windpipe. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't get my breath because this thing was caught in the windpipe. And I'm hacking and hacking and hacking. Boy, it takes you to a reverence for the simple act of breathing, doesn't it? So he goes on to say, it gives us perspective. He said, this is wise counsel, this life force that carries us. It gives us a perspective and sometimes peace, because it's not the local mind that's running the show. We're finding there's this peace that's guiding us. And then we can hope that it will run the show. So he said, this is wise counsel. But being a poet, as I am, I enter this universal space and I find myself just taking notes. I wait upon the Lord. I sit in the garden. I look at a rock. I have communion with a tree. I sit with a flower and I ask, what is your message? You know, I did an acronym for a flower and I painted it. It's on my wall in my house. Flower, F-L-O-W-E-R. Fragrance, laughing, opens, wildly, effortless, revealing, flower. So what if we could be like the flower, to let our fragrance, our laughter, open wildly with an effortless revealing, being an expression from the center, just like a flower would. He's saying the same thing. And then I enter it as the poet does, and I sit there and I take notes. I listen to the gospel of the flower as it speaks to my heart. He says, I lean into the stillness, and I lean into it with an open heart, he says. And I listen to everything, including my thoughts and my feelings and the entanglements of life. We're not here to exclude the entanglements. Bring them right to the surface. Let's look at them. And you know what's funny? When you look at something that's all tangled up, after a while it starts untangling itself, because you realize that your labeling it as all tangled up was keeping it tangled up. But once you started to just loosen up the threads, it begins to fall apart. I'm planting my boxes with the plants, and it, all on the cages was last year's vines, and they were all dried up. And you know how vines go? They twist on the cages. And Trey was over there with me, and he's rather anal and perfectionistic, and he said, you need to clean those vines off those cages so that the new vines can grow on the cages. So I found myself unwinding the vines and taking them off to create the new space. And so what if we do that with our own thought patterns? Just untangle those thoughts. I believe the mutual goal of meditation and of poetry is not to have us remove ourselves from this human journey, but rather, it's to have us live our lives more completely in relationship to the flow of this life force that carries us. We're having a relationship to this life flow. You feel it on a sailboat, I'm sure, where the wind is taking you and the water is carrying you. and you're being lifted up, and the sun is shining, and you are steering your ship. We can't stop the waves of change from happening, but we can learn to sail. We can learn how to set our sail. And then we trust in that journey. It's a metaphor. And so in his poetic ways, he concludes by saying, "My dear friend, the great visionary educator Parker Palmer says of this soul as a force of life at home in the wild terrain of your heart." The wild terrain of your heart, there is this hidden wholeness that by returning to center, you begin to discover the wild terrain of your heart. So the invitation is, when does your heart, when does your aboriginal soul flower within you? Could you be vigilant and attentive to that? Because there's something more that's happening than just this passion awakening, this yearning, this ache. It's the divine that's aching to express itself through each one of us. Children know it, but somehow when we get older, we suppress this drive to be the very divinity that we are. And lastly, he says, "When I can quiet my fears and wants and be as still as nature," he says, "then the living aspects of this universe will come out of the brush and they will nuzzle there beside me. Suddenly the raindrops that fall have a meaning." You know, the trees begin to communicate. And he says, "So at once, stillness brings us in alignment with our true nature," the stillness, "while also allowing the forms of life to touch us that are all around." And he said, "And I call all those things that touch me my teachers." My teachers. "Teach me and show me the way. I'll say to the mountain, teach me and show me the way. I'll say to the vast universe, teach me and show me the way. I'll say to the little inchworm, teach me and show me the way. I'll say to that little mouse, teach me and show me the way. Show me compassion so that I still have compassion." And so what if everything then becomes an opportunity to have an intimacy? And you know the word intimacy, you can say into me see, an intimacy with all of life. Then you're not separate. Last week I spoke about love from the Buddhist perspective when the Buddhist monk said, love is emptiness. And I remember seeing Ram Dass going, what? He couldn't understand love being emptiness. And then I saw the light bulb go on in Ram Dass. When he said, oh, when you're empty of the self that sees two, you know, you and me, right and wrong, good and bad, when you're empty of that self, there's no me there, attaching, possessing, grasping, expecting, he says, then love flows freely because there's no me in the way. You know, the only obstacle any of us has is the me person. And yet we all have a me person. So then how do you relate to the me person? As your ally, as your friend, as your child. And then you listen to the me person, knowing that the me person is doing the very best they can because they've been programmed and conditioned by their parents, by society. And we're evolving into a new order of being that's not about me anymore. It's never been about you, as my Sufi teacher would say. It's about this living energy, this presence, that when we return to center, we find it's the same light, the same light, the same love pouring through each one of us. And then enjoy the journey, and you will attract to you. This is the beautiful thing about the law of attraction. It's all the law of attraction. The law of attraction says like attracts like. So if you've been drawn to this teaching, it's because you're attracted to this message that's not about Jesus, that's about this indwelling presence. And then that attraction will draw other people to you, our Dharma recovery. It's like attracting like. It's not for everyone, but for those who want a different order of recovery that's more meditative-based, they will be drawn to this. It's not for everyone. So this isn't the kind of teaching that you try to impose on other people. It's the kind of place that you evolve into. And when you want the truth, as much as the drowning man wants that gasp of air, then the truth will reveal itself to you. But you have to want truth. And when we speak the truth with love, it's always heard with love. So don't be afraid to speak the truth, even if the world doesn't want to hear the truth. I thought of the sanctuary garden and who represents that to me. And I reflected on this beautiful man named Stanley Kuntz. He's a poet. He lived in Provincetown on Cape Cod. That's where he had his summer house. And this whole little book is about his gardens in Provincetown, how he saw them as a sacred place for him, a sanctuary for his heart to unfold. And because he is a poet, I just want to give you a taste of what he feels about the garden within and the garden without. They're not separate. They're the same. There's a beautiful says that you want to know what's in your consciousness, look what's in your world. because our world is a reflection of our consciousness. So when they say, Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? Well, if she's contrary, she's going to have a contrary garden. But if she has a garden filled with love, it's because she's sowing seeds of love. So B. Griffith, I mean, Stanley Kuntz has this, his way of approaching the garden. And he says, I conceive of the garden as a poem with many stanzas. And he says, each terrace contributes to the garden as a whole, in the same way that each stanza of a poem has a life of its own, and yet it's a part of a progressive whole as well. So it's the whole is the sum of its parts. The macrocosm is revealed in the microcosm. So he's saying the same thing of a garden. You know, if you were to come in my garden, hopefully after the COVID thing, I'll have a garden party and you can stroll through the garden. But it's the gestalt of the garden. It's the entering and walking down the pathways that I've hand laid and walking around the old trees and seeing the bulbs that are coming up and the ground covers and the ferns and then the moss that's everywhere. And you know, the only reason that we can have, we call our garden the moss garden, we have no grass because grass won't grow there because we have intense shade of the big trees. And so, but now because the trees have no leaves on, the moss, everything is just full sun, and the moss is bright green. And you realize everything, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, is interbeing. Everything relies on everything else. So the robins now are feasting in the moss, and they tear it apart to get at those worms. But you know the beautiful thing about the moss? It knows how to restore itself. And so when they rip the moss apart, the moss flies every which way, and it lands on the rocks. Well, then the moss, needing a new home, decides it's going to live on the rocks. And so you have the moss moving everywhere, layers, layers. And you can get fixated on one bed, or you can enter into the whole gestalt of the garden. This is what B. Griffith, Stanley Kuntz is saying. Each terrace contributes to the garden, and yet there's a progressive whole. And once you have perceived the garden as a whole, and your life as a garden, he says, then the individual tiers of the garden take on a different form because you've seen them both as part of it and as part of the whole. Now, one of the mysteries of gardening is that the garden reflects the viewer's own state of being at that time. We don't see what is, we see who we are. So someone might come to my garden and say, your garden is way too wild, it needs to be controlled, and I've been told that by some people. You know, because your version of what a garden is everything's in lines and straight lines and it's supposed to be, you know, conformed to this image of a garden. My garden is anything but conforming. So he says, one of the mysteries of gardening is that the garden reflects the viewer's own state of being, and just as your response to a poem lets you know something about your preoccupation of your susceptibility as you read it. Now, I'm going to close with one of his little poems. It's called The Snakes of September. And in his gardening, he found that these snakes were cohabiting his beautiful gardens, and he would hear them. They'd be rustling in a bush. He'd be slithering along the path. And you know, it gets cold in Cape Cod and it's September and you get some really pretty frigid nights up there. And he's looking for the snakes and he finds them still there, hanging from a tree, wrapped around one another like a love knot. And he says that we both have a covenant with this garden, you and I, the snakes and me. And he takes his old shriveled hand and he rubs up and down the snakes. And he says, and I feel them tremble under my hand. Now, you don't get any more intimate than stroking two snakes hanging upside down in a beautiful love knot, and you stroke them, and you feel that we're in this together. So this is the image of this man having a relationship with his garden. Lastly, he says, the garden communicates what it shows to you, but you also contribute to the garden some of what you are seeking in terms of your own life. It's a co-creation. Yes, it creates from the wildness of nature, but we're also participating by planting this and that's, and by nurturing and cutting. And we're in this together, you and me in the garden. You know, we feed the birds. Anybody feed the birds here? And then the squirrels decide they want to eat. And then before you know it, you have some really rambunctious little finches who shake the bird feeders so that all the bird seeds on the ground, and then all the mourning doves come. And there's got this little dance. And the other day, there was a very smart mockingbird who ripped open the suet feeder and carried the suet with him. I thought, my God, he's a smart little bird. Listen, this deer, he's walking through his garden, carrying his pans, probably in his 90s, tending his garden. And you know when you tend the garden, you're tended. One reason a garden can speak to us is that it's both its own reality and it's also a manifestation of an interior life of the mind that imagined it in its beginning. When I read that, it's a compilation of the wildness of its expression and then the mind that imagined it. When we bought the house 25 years ago, there was a drainage ditch by the goldsmith, and we didn't have any yard to speak of because of the trees. So I decided if I'm going to have a flower garden, it has to be in the drainage ditch. So I imagined the drainage ditch as a flower garden, and it truly is a beautiful garden. I noticed that certain things were planting themselves. Red buds were growing up in that drainage ditch. So now there's this huge red bud that will be blooming very soon. She grew up in that drainage ditch. Mother Nature planted her. I had a white dogwood in the front that died of some kind of disease, but she left one of her seedlings. And that seedling has now grown in 25 years, and now she's this beautiful dogwood who came back as a seedling from another tree. Well-meaning church people, Hank and Judy, they said, "What do you want in your new house?" And they have all these rocks in their land. I said, "A rock would be lovely." So Hank carried out this big rock from his land, and we have it now right in the front yard. And every time I go get the mail, I stand on that rock and open the door. Another lady in the church knew that I loved things from nature. Her name was Lillian LaRoche. LaRoche means rock. And she gave me, and you'll appreciate this, Jude, she traveled all the way from California, wherever she was. She was an old lady when I met her. And she carried this rock with her that she carried. Lillian LaRoche, Lillian the rock, she gave me her rock. So now that rock sits right in the middle of the moss garden, and every time I see it, I see Lillian. So this is the amazing thing. It's a co-creative process, and everybody participates in it. So here's the poem, The Snakes of September. Now remember, this is in layers, and I want you to feel this. This is so beautiful. He says, "All summer, I heard them rustling in the shrubbery, out racing me from tier to tier in my garden. There was a whisper among the viburnums. There was a signal flashed from the hedgerow, a shadow pulsing in the barberry thicket. And now that nights are all chilly and the annuals are all spent, I should have thought them gone in a torpor of blood, slipped to the netherworlds before the sickle frost. Not so," he says, "in the deceptive balm of noon, as if defiant of the curse that spoiled another garden, these two appear on show through a narrow slit in the dense green brocade of a North Country spruce. They're dangling head down, entwined with one another in a brazen love knot, in a brazen love knot. I put out my hand, and I stroke the fine, dry grit of their skin. After all, I say, we are partners in this land, you and I. We are co-signers of a covenant. And at my touch, the wild braid of creation trembles. And at my touch, the wild braid of creation trembles." So I'd like you to, in your mind's eye, imagine sharing this beautiful garden that we call life with all her creation. The birds that sing, the snakes that shrivel along the ground and climb the trees and wrap themselves in one another's embrace, looking for that little spot of sun to warm themselves. And know that it's all an aspect of self, the one self that we all share. And so when we come here on Sunday mornings, we come here to return to that center, a center that never left, a center that's always waiting. And I invite you to just feel that eternal something, that energy that Beat Griffith spoke about, that you see in all life. You'll see it in a flower blooming. You'll see it in a bird singing. You'll see it in a friend. You can see it in their eyes when they twinkle. And it's the light, it's the twinkle that you're seeing. You can say, "I'm looking at the friend," but when you realize that you're seeing that something that is shining through the friend, then you can rest in that question, what is that? Is that the light shining through? And what did it mean when Jesus says, don't let your light hide under a bushel, but let it shine? Or what did the Buddha mean when he said, be a light unto the world? Are they speaking about the same light? And are we passageways for the expression of that light? Could we feel into that? And then ask, where does this light emanate from? It's not from the finite self. It must be from some invisible something that is luminous by its very nature. And then we hear the first words in the Bible, let there be light. And what they referenced was Shekinah, which is the light within. So what if we could surrender into that light within, return to that light? We do that by consciously breathing. We do that by letting go of our story. We do that by saying, yes, I am opening. I am opening. My heart is ready to receive. And as we open our hearts, as we enter the beginner's mind, not having any answers, but having a vital curiosity and fascination, then the moment begins to awaken within us with its mystery and its context, in which it says, be. One of the great words in the Sufi tradition is the word kun. And kun means just be. To be or not to be, that is the question. Can we be that? Once we return to it, can we be that presence, shining in the world, offering itself up to whoever wants to drink from that love, from that light? It's so simple and yet so profound. And so all month long, we will be tending this sanctuary garden within and without. We will be having communion with all of life, who is preaching her mute gospel, who has never stopped preaching. And we will stop and we will listen with our hearts and hear the message of the universe that doesn't get louder but gets clearer when we become still. With so much gratitude for the ancestors that live in us, and for this eternal message that continues to evolve and flower as we turn toward it, then we live in gratitude for the ever-unfolding mystery of belonging to the universe. I invite you to place your hands over your heart chakra, and we'll join in the heart salutation by saying, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the deepest aspect of the self.
The deepest aspect of the self.
I return to center.
I return to center.
And I discover you're waiting there.
I discover you're waiting there.
Knowing that all is well.
All is well.
I open my heart, my mind, and my life to offer it back in service to the One. That's kind of a complicated thing, but you got the message. So knowing that you're the one that we've been waiting for, let your light shine. Thank you for sending in your tithes, y'all. Put your clocks ahead next week. And if you want to be in the class, let Jody Rutenberg know, and she'll sign you up for the Zoom class. Mask up.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.